The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're learning about some of the legal chemicals that regulate the moods of millions of people every day. This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm here with Murray Carpenter, who holds a degree in psychology from the University of Colorado and a master's in environmental studies from the University of Montana. Murray has reported on caffeine-related stories for the New York Times, NPR, and Wired magazine, and he's the author of Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Hello, Murray.
Hi, Desiree.
Now, you'd been writing about caffeine for years and years before publishing this book. Is this a personal obsession? And there's no judgment at all because I very much love my caffeine.
It's definitely a personal obsession, and it's one that dates back 30 years. When I was studying psychology, you mentioned I studied psychology at the University of Colorado. I was not a coffee drinker up until then. And I happened to live off campus sophomore year, and between where I lived and the college campus was a wonderful little bookstore cafe called Brilliant Works. And my friends and I used to stop there for coffee on the way to campus. And that's where I got initiated into coffee drinking. And I recognized how it really helped me focus for studying and writing projects. And that's sort of where this whole obsession began.
How much of this book was written on coffee?
The entire thing, absolutely.
Now, the caffeine story itself actually starts with chocolate.
That's right. Yeah, the earliest physical evidence we have for the human use of caffeine comes from the part of what's now Central America, the border between Guatemala and Mexico. This is on the Pacific coast. There's a swampy, very wet. A rainy area called the Soconusco region. And 3,500 years ago, the people that lived there were using cacao, the nut that produces cocoa, that produces chocolate, in frothy drinks. And archaeologists have been able to dig up their vessels and find traces of caffeine and chocolate in those vessels. And so that's the earliest physical evidence we have for the human use of caffeine.
Well, and how much caffeine was actually in those frothy drinks, maybe compared to a cup of present-day coffee?
That's a great question. I've tried to calculate that. And I think, you know, if you had a moderate dose of one of those frothy drinks, by the way, you can still get similar drinks in the public squares of this region, like in Tapachula, Mexico. They're now sweetened, which they weren't at that time. I think they, you know, would have had approximately, you know, a strong mug of that would have had approximately 80 milligrams of caffeine, maybe 50 to 80 milligrams. And this would be roughly equivalent to two cups of strong tea or a shot of espresso. But, you know, that's really a guess. We don't know how much they consumed and how strong it was. But, you know, concurrent to when they were starting to use chocolate in that area, that's also about the era in which people in Asia were learning that tea leaves steeped in water would also give them this pleasant, stimulating effect.
So now people were discovering their various personal favorite forms of caffeine all over the world, weren't they?
They were, yeah. And I mean, that's one of the interesting things about it. I mean, caffeine itself is a simple chemical compound that exists in plants worldwide, where its primary function seems to be as an insecticide. But wherever it exists, people have quickly learned to put it to use as a stimulant. And one of the sort of quirky things about caffeine, most of us get most of our caffeine from coffee. And coffee is sort of a newer arrival on the scene. Humans probably didn't start using coffee until about 1,500 years ago in Eastern Africa.
Well, how did caffeine wind up being such a huge part of our daily lives in North America?
Well, you have to sort of follow these lines, all of these different historical lines. You know, back in Africa, it's worth noting that the historical uses tend to really be tied up in its stimulating effect. So, you know, the origin myths for caffeine in Asia was that there was a emperor who was, you know, drinking hot water and some tea leaves blew into his hot water and he drank it and he became stimulated. He liked the feeling. And, you know, then tea culture was born. In Eastern Africa, it was that a goat herd was watching his goats. The goats nibbled on these berries. The goats became frisky. The goat herd nibbled some himself. He became frisky. And so that's how coffee culture was born. I think it's this pleasant, stimulating effect that sort of gradually made both coffee and tea and even chocolate more popular. All of these cultures grew, you know, in their own region. So, you know, tea culture in Asia, chocolate culture in Central America, and coffee culture in Africa, and then gradually migrated outward. And, you know, it was actually chocolate that really took Europe by storm before coffee did.
Well, when did coffee, I guess, hit its peak in North America?
So this is another sort of strange thing, counterintuitive thing that I ran across as I was doing my reporting, is that coffee consumption in the U.S. peaked shortly after World War II, somewhere probably between 1946 and 1950, is when we were drinking the most coffee per capita. And it's declined pretty dramatically since. And I think the reason I find, and most of us find this to be counterintuitive, is because now we have such a sort of elaborate and prominent coffee culture with Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Tim Hortons on every corner. And yet we really don't drink as much coffee as our grandparents did. So yeah, coffee consumption hit its peak here probably around 1950, at least in the United States.
Well, there was a certain point in the 50s where coffee consumption was falling just as production was ramping up, right?
As coffee consumption started to fall in the 1950s and production was ramping up, and this is, you know, a constant battle in coffee is these cycles of surplus and dearth. But at that point, the coffee growers were trying to look for ways to sort of separate themselves in the marketplace. And one of the interesting things that emerged from this era was the Colombian marketing guy, I don't know what you would call him, an icon of coffee marketing, Juan Valdez, who really distinguished Colombian coffee in the marketplace. I mean, up until the time when Juan Valdez came around in the late 50s and early 60s, coffee was really just coffee, and the country of origin was not something that most people paid attention to. And what he helped to do was to distinguish Colombian coffee in the marketplace and also sort of pave the way for this whole generation that we have now of people who not only know the country of origin of their coffee, but, you know, maybe the types of berries or even the farm that they were grown on.
Well, the marketing around coffee is just amazing. Even the phrase coffee break was a marketing tactic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and you're right. The marketing around coffee is remarkable. Coffee break was a marketing effort, I think, that began in the 1950s, and I think coffee marketing for sure, and I would say, you know, caffeine marketing in a broader sense as well, is something that's so sort of ubiquitous that we almost don't even notice it. I mean, there are coffee ads pretty much everywhere you look. And I think as well, we see now soft drink ads for caffeinated soft drinks pretty much everywhere you look.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking to Murray Carpenter about his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Now, it wasn't just the marketing that made caffeine so popular. As you said, it's that caffeine has a very specific effect that we seem to enjoy very much.
I think the shortest way to say this is the caffeine just makes you feel good. And again, it's not going to have this effect on everyone. And its effects vary dramatically on different people. But for most people, a little bit of caffeine can elevate your mood. And, you know, what it really tends to do is alleviate fatigue and boost your mood, make you energetic, even sociable. So it has sort of a wide-ranging effects that most of us perceive to be positive.
Well, now, how does it work exactly? Okay, let's say I take a sip of coffee, and I'm actually going to take a sip of coffee. And for reference, that was a dark roast. Black is midnight on a moonless night. So now what? Now, what is the caffeine doing right now internally?
Okay, so right now it's not doing much. You're going to have to wait about 20 minutes. And that's one of the interesting things about caffeine ingested orally is it does take a little bit of time to take effect. There are other ways that you can take caffeine that might give you the effect more quickly, and we could talk about that later. But typically, what caffeine will do when you ingest it orally is it will take about 15 minutes for enough of the caffeine to get into your bloodstream, and it's a small, simple molecule. It will nimbly leap the blood-brain barrier and get into your brain. And once it's in your brain, it's caffeine's primary mechanism is to block the action of a neurotransmitter called adenosine. Caffeine looks to the neuroreceptor very much like adenosine. It can sit in adenosine's place and not allow adenosine to send its signal to the brain. And adenosine's primary function is to tell the brain when we're tired or we're fatigued. So by simply doing this, caffeine allows us to feel more energetic.
And caffeine has been studied extensively, so much so that the sheer amount of data is actually terribly confusing. So let's try and sort that out. Does caffeine provide physical benefits? I know it does anecdotally, but you mentioned a couple of benefits already.
Yeah, no, so it absolutely does. So, you know, one is the one I mentioned, alertness. And so this can help, it helps you or I, people who are just, you know, chronic caffeine users or coffee users, to feel more alert. It's worth noting that, you know, once you're a chronic or, you know, habituated caffeine user, at least some of your caffeine dose is simply alleviating withdrawal to get you back up to baseline.
Right.
But that notwithstanding, it does allow you to feel more alert. And so, you know, this is helpful not just for radio hosts and journalists, but also for people like long haul truck drivers and enlisted people in the military. Some of the best caffeine research has come from the military because soldiers are so often in a position where they're sleep deprived and yet need to be vigilant. And it's these kinds of situations in which you might have infrequent but potentially life-threatening stimuli that caffeine can help people to maintain alertness and vigilance. So, you know, that's one that, you know, this sense of increasing alertness. Another is, and this is pretty, I spent a lot of time on this book because it's pretty dramatic. It can really boost your athletic performance.
That was some of the most interesting research. Can you actually talk about Ganyo and the timed performance?
I talked to a couple of researchers in Hawaii who have been studying this extensively. A moderate dose of caffeine, what a coffee drinker, you know, might have in the morning, say a couple of strong cups of coffee. If you were to take a moderate dose of caffeine and then compete, say, in an hour-long timed foot race or go on an hour-long bike race or ride an exercise bike in a lab, your performance would probably be 1 to 3% better with the caffeine than without. And so, you know, that's for most people, you'd get that sort of benefit. That's pretty dramatic. So your time would be 1 to 3% lower. And of course, that would be, in many races, the winning margin. So this is one of the reasons that exercise physiologists have spent a lot of time studying caffeine and why a lot of companies are producing products, gels, etc., specifically geared towards athletes. one of the researchers I interviewed, Harris Lieberman, did some research with Navy SEALs. And Navy SEALs, in order to become a Navy SEAL, which is one of the special forces in the U.S., you have to go through this rigorous training that most, or I would say probably half of the candidates don't make it through. It's called Hell Week. And the candidates go through this whole week of intense physical and mental activity and very, very little sleep. And they're presented with sort of no-win situations. And it's basically to see how these people deal with extreme physical and mental stress. During the week, they're typically not allowed to use caffeine. And what Lieberman did was he took a subset of these SEALs and administered caffeine and then checked to see how they performed on a number of different cognitive functions and marksmanship, and found that virtually across the board, caffeine on these sleep-deprived, challenged people were benefited from caffeine. I think the one thing that didn't benefit but was sort of flat was marksmanship. But it's just another indication that for people who are, you know, in extreme stress and sleep deprived, caffeine can have benefits. And because of this and similar research, the U.S. military has spent a lot of time developing specific products that go in soldiers' rations to provide caffeine in different forms. And among those is a chewing gum that's specially formulated. And this chewing gum, we talked about this earlier, about how long it takes caffeine to take effect. This chewing gum seems to be able to hit the caffeine seems to be able to take effect more quickly, likely because it's being absorbed through the mucous membranes in your mouth. And so instead of peaking, say, at 20 to 30 minutes, your caffeine levels might start to amp up within like 5 to 10 minutes. And that's something that can have benefits for civilians as well.
And is that available to the public?
It is available to the public. There's a subcontractor who was making military gum under the brand Stay Alert. They've got a new brand name. I don't remember it. Maybe Military Energy Gum. I don't remember what it's called now. But yeah, there are gums available to the public.
Now, it also might help with depression?
There seems to be an association between decreased depression and caffeine use.
I like your tentativeness.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's really hard to prove cause and effect with this kind of mm-hmm. thing. There are just so many factors that can go into it. But yes, there seems to be an association between caffeine use, at least in women, and a decreased incidence of depression.
There's even one study that suggests that it might protect against Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and this is fascinating. I think we need more research in this area. The mechanisms are not clear. There's some very strong suggestions here that it may help. And again, in this case, it's probably caffeinated coffee that most of the research has been done on. And it's worth noting here that for a lot of the medical research, it's been, at least the large-scale research, it's been on caffeinated coffee, because that's the way most of us take our caffeine. And coffee has other constituents that may be responsible for any of its benefits or any of its harmful effects as well. So there's just, I would say, a little bit of noise in some of the caffeine research because it's just hard. There's not as much caffeine research on pure caffeine.
Well, don't worry. We won't let people get too excited because there's tons of research showing horrible things about caffeine. There's some evidence of a relationship between caffeine and insomnia, anxiety, and panic.
One, I think most of us really understand that caffeine can disrupt your sleep. I mean, I think everybody gets that. Even here, there's a caveat because there are some people, and I think we all know people like this, one or two of them anyway, who can sort of drink coffee or consume caffeine right up to the moment they go to sleep and sleep like babies. But for most of us, you know that if you have, say, a double espresso after dinner or a large cup of coffee, you'll have that sort of feeling. You're lying there in bed, thoughts racing, you know, heart thumping, thinking, you know, I wish I hadn't had that. I'm not going to sleep well. So yeah, caffeine can mess with your sleep, and it can do it in more subtle ways than we think. That even, you know, a cup of coffee in the morning can give you a discernible sleep pattern, you know, at 3 o'clock the next morning. So a lot of people sleep fine and use caffeine and sleep fine, but I think there's certainly some group of the population that uses caffeine that sleeps badly and really has never, you know, taken, say, a month off of caffeine to see how much it benefits their sleep. It won't benefit. Everyone won't benefit from eliminating caffeine from their diet. But some people who have trouble sleeping will clearly benefit from either reducing or eliminating caffeine from their diet. So, yes, sleep is a huge one. And anxiety is a really interesting one because, I mean, well, first of all, for most of us, if you just have, even if you're not prone to anxiety, if you happen to have too much caffeine, and I think most of us have done this, you know, at one time or another, you just have one too many refills, you can sort of get this anxious, jangly feeling. But for people who are prone to anxiety, caffeine can really trigger significant feelings of anxiety. Many people who are anxious have learned to stay away from caffeine, but there are certainly some people who don't associate their anxiety with caffeine use. And just anecdotally, from talking to people who have discussed this with doctors and from talking to doctors, I'm not convinced that when doctors are discussing anxiety with their patients, that the first thing that they talk about is caffeine use. And I think it's important, and I think it deserves more attention. Sort of on the more acute side here, people who suffer from panic attacks, people who have panic disorder, you can reliably induce panic attacks in people who are, you know, genetically predisposed to having panic attacks with a single strong dose of caffeine, of caffeinated coffee. So yeah, the associations between or you know, the way that caffeine can trigger anxiety in some people is significant, and it's again, like sleep, I would say for people who use caffeine habitually and suffer from anxiety, it's worth moderating caffeine use or eliminating it for a while just to see if it helps. It may not help, but it's worth checking.
Well, actually, there was some research, Griffith's research, actually. He and a number of people took themselves off coffee, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Withdrawal, I guess, would be another unpleasant aspect of habitual caffeine use. What these researchers did was they actually moderated their caffeine intake first, and then did a series of experiments, double-blind experiments, to see what happened when they eliminated coffee from their diets. And what they found is pretty remarkable, which is that at just 100 milligrams of caffeine consumption daily. Now, this is not much. This would be 3 cans of Coca-Cola. It would be perhaps as little as 5 ounces of coffee, maybe 2 cups of strong black tea. But for people who are using just 100 milligrams of caffeine daily, they will reliably experience withdrawal when they abruptly cease taking caffeine. So, and withdrawal has a variety of symptoms. I think the best known is the sort of caffeine headache that most people notice when they stop caffeine. But there are others. I mean, irritability, lethargy, of course, and muscle pain is another one. So, yeah, withdrawal is a very significant sort of side effect of habitual caffeine use.
Okay, so we have these wonderful benefits and these very concerning detriments to coffee. So where is the line? Where's the line that says caffeine is bad for us versus good for us?
People ask me this all the time, and I wish I had sort of a quick and easy answer. You know, say 250 milligrams is good, 300 is bad. But if that was the case, it would have been a much easier book to research and to write. The fact is, a different amount of caffeine is going to work for all of us. And part of this has to do with the fact that we all have varying susceptibility to caffeine's effects. And a lot of this has to do with genetics. I mean, some people are just genetically highly susceptible to caffeine or highly sensitive to caffeine. Others are not sensitive at all. And there are other sort of strange ways that caffeine can interact with other drugs that affect how intensely you will feel the caffeine. And one example is that smokers metabolize caffeine more quickly than non-smokers. So smokers really need almost twice as much caffeine to get the same effect as a non-smoker. Conversely, women on birth control pills metabolize caffeine more slowly, so need less caffeine to get the same effect. This is a long-winded way of saying the right amount of caffeine is going to be different for every person. Of course, you have to factor weight in as well, because the dose is going to be weight dependent. Having said that, I think the important thing is to really pay close attention to your body and listen to what your body is saying. If you're sleeping well, you're not anxious, you're happy with your caffeine consumption, then it's probably a good thing. If you have some sort of side effect that might be related to caffeine use, then it's worth, again, moderating your caffeine use or eliminating it for a while.
And of course, I have to ask, since we're talking about the negative side, is caffeine addictive? It seems like a big question.
It's a big question, and it's one, I don't want to say accosted, but I've had some intense conversations with people since the book came out about this very thing, and I anticipated this. So I tried to be clear in the introduction. I do use the terms addictive and addiction, to describe the drug and its effect on people in the book. But I try to be clear in the intro about what I mean. And what I mean is, like other addictive drugs, people who like caffeine will tend to use it daily to develop a partial tolerance to it, to crave it, to feel lousy when they're not taking it, and experience some form of withdrawal. I mean, a pretty predictable syndrome of withdrawal. So any of these alone don't constitute an addiction. I think taken together, it seems to me like it's at least what the layperson considers an addictive drug. There are a number of people who say addiction really has to involve a whole range of negative sort of social effects, people who are missing work, right, or sick, or really don't want to be addicted to a drug and they can't stop. And caffeine usually doesn't meet those as well. Having said that, there is some subset of the population who would like to moderate or eliminate caffeine from their diet who are unable to. So I think maybe the best way to characterize its addictiveness is to use what one of my sources used, the modifier mild. So to call it a mildly addictive drug and call it a mild addiction.
Now, would that be scientific consensus, that answer?
It's not scientific consensus, no. And, there are people who write entire books about what is addiction and what is not. Our sense as a society of what constitutes addiction, I think, is evolving. I don't think anyone has a lock on being able to claim, the definition of what is addictive. So no, there's not scientific consensus that caffeine is an addictive drug. And, But I do think, I think I would consider it a mildly addictive drug.
You're tuned into Science for the People, and I'll be back with Murray Carpenter and his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us, after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest is Murray Carpenter, the author of Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Now, we've spoken a bit about the science around caffeine, but some of the most interesting research comes from the need to provide evidence of its safety, specifically to regulators. So maybe start out by telling us a story about the famous Coca-Cola case.
Yeah, this was one of those little gifts that researchers sometimes get. I stumbled across a court case that happened in the U.S. in 1911 that pitted the agency that preceded the FDA, it was then called the Bureau of Chemistry, pitted this agency against Coca-Cola over the issue of added caffeine. Now, at the time, that agency, the Bureau of Chemistry, was led by hard-charging man named Harvey Wiley, who was a real pure foods advocate. And he felt that Coca-Cola was adding an addictive drug to its product, and that was caffeine, of course. He felt they were marketing it to children, and he felt that the federal government should have a role in regulating it. And his agent seized a load of Coca-Cola. It led to this dramatic trial in Chattanooga. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court and eventually was settled with a consent decree because Coca-Cola had changed its formula in the interim and said that the original case no longer applied. But several interesting things came out of this. There was some very good early caffeine research, and there was another really interesting sort of tidbit is that because it was a court case, there was a lot of documentation of caffeine contents of popular consumer products. So, for example, at that time, an 8-ounce serving of Coca-Cola, which was a common serving size, had much more caffeine than it does today. It had as much caffeine as a modern Red Bull. And that surprised me when I read that. But it also set up this sort of uneasy relationship between the federal government and industry over the issue of caffeine. And part of the problem with that case and a challenge that regulators still face today is the issue that consumer products like Coca-Cola rarely have as much caffeine, as high a caffeine concentration as coffee. And so the conversation often gets to a point at which you say, well, if this product doesn't have as much caffeine as coffee, and we all drink coffee every day, what would you do next? Regulate coffee? And most people think that's sort of untenable. So the conversation often tends to stop right there.
Well, the FDA has always had kind of a problematic relationship with caffeine, has it not?
It has. And I'd spent some time talking to the agency and their staffers, and I think they're a little behind on this issue of regulation, but it's worth noting the challenge is different than with virtually any other product because it is a psychoactive drug. It is, as I said earlier, a mildly addictive psychoactive drug, but it's also one that most people are taking every single day.
Right.
So it's automatically in a different class than sort of anything else. So yeah, it's got challenges and it comes through in funny ways. So if you buy, say, an over-the-counter medication such as Vivarin, you know, it has to have not only the caffeine contents labeled, but it also has to have an advisory statement for people sensitive to caffeine, pregnant women, etc. But if you buy the same amount of caffeine in just a dietary supplement or an energy drink, there's no such labeling requirement. So depending on how it's sold, it falls under a different regulatory regime.
And hasn't Canada done this quite differently, dealing with caffeine?
Almost the rest of the world has done this quite differently. So yeah, Canada's way ahead of us. Health Canada had established some regulations looking at energy drinks that not only limit the amount of caffeine that can be sold per serving of the energy drinks, but also requires the basic information that any consumer needs when they're buying one of these products, which is how much caffeine is in the product. Further, Health Canada has advisory statements on the label. So, you know, for pregnant women, children, people sensitive to caffeine. And it's worth noting that this is sort of, I think, common sense practice that not only Health Canada, but also the European Union and the United Kingdom will be instituting similar regulations, I think, in November of this year. So this I think is a coming trend, and I suspect these regulations provide a template for what FDA might do. FDA is right now in the process of assessing what it might do to regulate this whole new class of energy products.
Well, and are there different regulations around synthetic versus natural caffeine?
There aren't, and I'm glad you brought that up. This is so the caffeine that's added in powdered form to consumer products. So this is not the caffeine we're consuming that naturally occurs in coffee, tea, or chocolate, but caffeine that's added to, say, soft drinks or energy drinks, or any of these new breed of products. The caffeine powder can be produced two different ways. One way, and the way I think we all would suspect it's produced, is that it can be extracted from one of those natural products. So it can be extracted from tea. It can be extracted from coffee as part of the decaffeination process. There's a plant in Montreal that produces a good amount of powdered caffeine and also decaffeinates coffee. That's one way to do it. The cheaper way, and the way that's become more popular, is to actually synthesize caffeine in pharmaceutical plants. And so now the bulk of our caffeine that we import into the United States is synthetic caffeine that's made in pharmaceutical plants, primarily in China, but also in Germany and India. It's not regulated any differently. In fact, you know, if there are no impurities on either refined or synthetic caffeine, it should be, you know, either should be just as healthy. They're functionally the same in the body. It's the same chemical. And the only way you really can tell them apart is by really sort of carbon dating them, because the synthetic caffeine will be the chemical precursors come from fossil fuels. And so will have been photosynthesized, the carbon will have been photosynthesized much longer ago.
This is Science for the People, and I'm talking to Murray Carpenter about his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. So we have come a long, long way since just the days of coffee and pop. So you've mentioned energy drinks, but what does contemporary caffeine industry, what does it look like?
It's kind of gone nuts. And it poses challenges for regulators because, you know, for example, just energy drinks themselves, they sort of appeared on the market, first Red Bull in the U.S. and then all these other imitators and successors. But then they were closely followed by 5-hour energy shots, the small vials of sort of a concentrated caffeine slurry that are very popular here in the U.S. There's now caffeinated chewing gum. There are caffeinated sort of spray inhalers. Additionally, we talked about the caffeine that the caffeinated products that are formulated specifically for athletes. So there, caffeine is now being produced in a greater variety and abundance of different forms than ever before, and I see no signs of this trend letting up. I mean, it's good business.
But there has been a decline in coffee use over the years.
There's been a decline in coffee use. Yeah, yeah, this dramatic decline.
I'm a purist.
Yeah, well, and I love coffee too. And I did, you know, as I researched the book, I went through all of these other products, and I even, you know, just to make sure that it was just the caffeine, I spent a few days like just having caffeine from colas and energy drinks and everything else. But I always come back to coffee. And I think there is an eternal appeal about coffee. It still provides, at least in the American diet, about 2/3 of the caffeine that we consume. So it has declined, but it's still far and away our favorite source of caffeine.
Now, throughout the book, I feel like you've been very tentative on a number of levels. Has this experience writing this book changed your perception of caffeine?
Yeah, I would say it's given me more respect for caffeine. I think I was motivated to write the book by the feeling that caffeine really doesn't get the respect it deserves in our culture. It influences so much of our daily activities. It's coursing through our bloodstreams every day. It has a huge effect on commerce, worth more than $120 billion annually retail, caffeinated products are in the U.S. So I think it doesn't get the respect it deserves. I think after writing the book, I respect caffeine more, and I hopefully understand it a little better, but I think I treat it with a little more thoughtfully, and I think I use it more systematically than I used to. For example, I mean, as with any drug, I think you want to take the lowest effective dose. And so instead of drinking, you know, guzzling a larger cup of coffee first thing in the morning, I'll often take a small cup and then another small cup later in order to sort of not be overdoing it. And I've even reduced my caffeine consumption slightly. I'm still a heavy caffeine user. I'm probably among coffee drinkers, I would probably be considered moderate, like 300 to 400 milligrams a day, which would be, oh, say 18 to 24 ounces of coffee. But I'm using a little bit less than I did before. And I would say maybe I'm a little more strategic about it.
Well, I feel like I should apologize, but all that I did the entire time I read your book was stroke my coffee cup lovingly.
Well, that's great. I don't want to scare anyone away, and I think some people have gotten the sense that it's a cautionary book. I just think I love caffeine. I love coffee, and I just think I think it deserves more understanding and respect.
Murray, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for your interest in the book.
We've linked to Murray Carpenter and his book, Caffeinated, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back to talk about what research can and can't tell us about e-cigarettes right after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're listening back to a discussion of taboo sexual practices and whether they're really as unusual as we think. Psychologist and author Jesse Baring talks about his book, Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. And we'll speak to Nicole Prowse, principal investigator at UCLA's Sexual Psychophysiology and Effective Neuroscience Laboratory, on her neurological perspective that raises doubts about self-reported sex addiction. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm here with Dr. David Gorski, a surgical oncologist and associate professor at Wayne State University in Detroit. He's chairman of the board for the Society for Science-Based Medicine, and he's also an editor and contributor of the online blog Science-Based Medicine, which explores issues and controversies in the relationship between science and medicine. It's dedicated to evaluating the medical treatments and products of interest to the public in a scientific light, and promoting the highest standards and traditions of science and healthcare. David, thanks very much
for being
here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we tried to do a segment about e-cigarettes a few years ago, and we couldn't seem to find enough research on the topic. But recently, there have been a number of studies published. Why is it getting all this attention now?
It obviously has to do with the increasing popularity of these devices. Jenny McCarthy's been seen, doing ads for blue e-cigarettes, and you see them more and more. They seem to be becoming more prevalent or more popular, and so there's more interest in them, whether they actually do what is claimed.
So why did it take so long for the research community to start looking into these?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know that I have a good answer for that. The idea, of course, is just to have the nicotine high without you know, all the nasty toxic stuff that goes along with burning, you know, plant matter. And these were, you know, these were invented, you know, I forget how many years ago, but maybe a decade ago. I think only now they've found their way to, you know, the United States and Europe and have become, you know, much more popular, and the marketing has gotten very sophisticated.
So looking at the research that that's coming out in the last few months, is what we're seeing good research, or is it still mostly preliminary?
What I've seen mostly has been pretty preliminary. Now, the last time I wrote about this, I admit, was in August of last year, so I may not be up on the most recent studies, but I do recall reading about them and not thinking that there was much more to them than what was out when I had, you know, first written about this last year. So, I mean, a lot of this is pretty preliminary, you know, and in fairness, you know, it's hard to say one way or the other. You know, they might actually be very good for smoking cessation. It's just that the evidence out there isn't so great right now.
Okay, well, let's try and break down what we do know. What's in e-cigarette vapor?
Well, there's usually some sort of carrier, which is usually propylene glycol, although some use vegetable glycerin, which is, you know, heated by some heating element and turned into a vapor. And into that carrier or base is nicotine. In varying amounts from zero to a lot, and various flavorings, to make it more attractive. You know, and one of the criticisms for e-cigarettes is some of these flavorings seem to, you know, be of the sort that might make them more attractive to children and get them hooked on nicotine, or even potentially serve as a gateway to actual tobacco smoking.
So what do we know about the liquid nicotine? Do we know if it's safe?
Well, you know, nicotine is a drug, like any, you know, like many other drugs, and it's relatively safe in the general doses that you get in. I mean, it's safe in the short term. Obviously, in the long term, you know, smoking cigarettes is associated with all sorts of bad things. Some of which is due to the nicotine. A lot of which is not. But you know, the liquid that they give to put in the e-cigarettes is very concentrated and potentially very toxic, you know, if children get their hands on it. And I do believe there have been, you know, some instances of that. But, you know, it's basically, you know, habit forming, obviously. It's the main reason people get addicted to cigarettes. And the idea, which is not an entirely unreasonable idea, it's just that there's not a lot of evidence, is that e-cigarettes, because they give you the nicotine high without all that other stuff, or at the very least safer. The question of whether they're a good smoking cessation device, though, I think is pretty much still up in the air.
You mentioned some of the poisonings that we've heard about on the news, and there have certainly been some news articles in the last few months warning that some e-liquids are neurotoxins and even in small doses can be dangerous and poisonous. I read in one New York Times article that said, tiny amounts, whether ingested or absorbed through the skin, can cause vomiting and seizures and even be lethal. Based on what you know about e-cigarettes, is this typical media hyperbole at work and scaremongering, or is there something serious here that warrants these kinds of statements?
This is more of a concern, you know, as far as children getting their hands on it, because if you're careful and you don't, you know, get the stuff on your skin or somehow ingest a bunch of it, you know, it should be pretty safe. But, you know, that we all know that children are, you know, are not careful and do not, and could easily get this on their skin. It can be absorbed through the skin, of course. So I think that's part of the main concern. Another part of the concern is just how much they can crank up the dose of nicotine in these things. Some of these e-cigs have no nicotine in them, or, you know, you can basically, it depends what you fill them with. You know, you can fill them with whatever, you know, contents you want, you know, whether it's just the propylene glycol base or the base plus however much nicotine, you know, you can buy the strength that you want.
Interesting. Can you do that? I'm not a smoker myself, so I'm not sure. Is that similar to how you can buy regular cigarettes, or is this sort of a new quote-unquote feature of the e-cigarette that you can control the amount of nicotine?
Well, I mean, you can certainly control it much more precisely because, you know, it tells you how much is in the liquid. And, you know, in cigarettes, it's, you know, obviously we know from past experience that the tobacco companies did manipulate levels of nicotine in the tobacco. So, of course, that's a lot less precise than what you can do with e-cigarettes.
So we talked a little bit about the liquid nicotine. I want to talk about the vapor as well, because that's been causing some concern among some people. In a lot of cases, it's propylene glycol. Do we know if that's harmful on its own?
It's used in a lot of things, and it's not clear whether propylene glycol in the form that it's inhaled in is completely safe, but I tend to doubt that it's particularly dangerous. I mean, the nicotine is more what I worry about.
Do we know if there's been any research on secondhand vapor and its effects on people?
There hasn't been a lot, you know, in terms of the secondhand e-cigarette vapor. Certainly there's been nowhere near as much research on that as there has been on secondhand smoke, which is known to cause problems, most particularly cardiac issues, more so than, you know, increasing the risk of lung cancer. It's pretty much a black box where it's not really known whether it's a hazard or not.
Now, there's been a lot of talk that e-cigarettes might be a gateway to nicotine addiction. Have we seen that borne out anywhere?
You know, that's a tough one because, you know, a lot of the people who use e-cigarettes all are smokers or the other way around. And it's not yet clear whether this is, you know, actually serving as a gateway to cigarettes.
I guess when we talk about gateways and addiction, what we're usually talking about here is kids and teenagers. Have we done any research on the use of e-cigarettes in younger populations?
To be honest, I can't say I'm real familiar with that particular bit of data. So it would be, you know, a lot of what I've seen are, you know, bias-laden surveys and, you know, testimonials. And, you know, it's hard for me to determine one way or the other whether it's actually true or not. There is an idea that the thing about e-cigarettes, or an argument that you'll sometimes hear people make, is that they are a means of harm reduction. You know, in other words, they are less harmful than cigarettes, even if they are potentially just as addictive, depending on how much nicotine is in them. That may or may not be a philosophical difference, because a lot of tobacco control involves, you know, getting people off of tobacco altogether, you know, including nicotine.
One of the most fascinating things I'm finding about all the conversations that are happening right now around e-cigarettes is how polarizing the topic is. There's a lot of people who are speaking out about them a lot and very vehemently, and then there's a lot of people who are really big supporters, and it's difficult to find the science in the middle ground in between. Why do you think this issue is so polarizing?
There are anti-tobacco activists claiming that e-cigarettes are almost as bad as cigarettes and they're gateway drugs to children. And then on the other hand, we see these promoters of e-cigarettes who make these concrete, absolutist statements that they are safe and that they are effective aids to cessation. And, you know, all I can conclude is that the evidence base doesn't support either of them that strongly. Or at least, at the very least, that both have a tendency to overstate their cases. The e-cigarette apologists are definitely overstating their case more, in my opinion, because they, you know, they'll bring up this apocalyptic rhetoric of regulators killing smokers by not letting them have e-cigarettes so that they can quit smoking. There's one group that I've, you know, that you might have heard of, who is frequently, you know, pointed to as being on the side of, you know, skeptics and science-based medicine, you know, the American Council on Science and Health, or ACSH. I've always been kind of torn about them, or at least I've been torn about them since I learned their history as being heavily funded by industry. But on the other hand, you know, when they're right, they're right. Now, one particularly odd thing about ACSH is that it's one of the groups making these kinds of absolutist statements on e-cigarettes. I happen to be on the ACSH mailing list, and it seems like hardly a day goes by without them sending out a message, you know, touting e-cigarettes in some way or attacking critics of e-cigarettes some way. And you know, and I just can't figure it out because the evidence is nowhere near as concrete as they make it sound.
A lot of people talk about, and you know, we've talked about it a little bit, about e-cigarettes as a smoking cessation tool, so a way to cut down or even quit on smoking. Have there been any research or tests done of whether or not this is an effective method to quit?
Here's the thing. Most of the studies that I've looked at have been really bad. You know, it was like very, very frustratingly so. You know, they've been surveyed, like internet surveys are being touted as you know, studies showing that the cessation works. There is a randomized study going on out there whose preliminary data was somewhat promising, but there haven't been any really good randomized, you know, double-blind placebo-controlled type studies to determine whether e-cigarettes are a good smoking cessation tool. If there, you know, I will admit I haven't looked into this in a few months, so if there's something that's been published, I might not be aware of it. But as of the last time I went through the data, I didn't see anything that was a particularly convincing study one way or the other. Now, in all fairness, the existing smoking cessation aids we have are not particularly, you know, are disappointingly effective. You know, nicotine patches are not the greatest tool in the world. On the other hand, in my view, e-cigarettes are clearly drug delivery devices. They are devices designed to introduce a given dose of nicotine into the lungs in a carrier for, you know, the effect of nicotine. As such, it boggles my mind that these, you know, were not regulated by the FDA as drug delivery devices.
Okay, so based on what we know right now, if you're going to smoke regardless, should you switch to e-cigarettes or consider switching to e-cigarettes for the sake of your health, or should you just stick to regular cigarettes?
You know, it's hard to say because some of the health issues for, you know, do come from the nicotine. I mean, if you're going to switch to a nicotine-free vapor, which probably won't work, then e-cigarettes are almost certainly safer. However, if you're going to be imbibing nicotine into your lungs, I'm not sure which would come out on top. You know, we still don't actually have any long-term studies on e-cigarettes because they haven't been around that long.
I think partly the problem is we hear a lot about the smoke part of smoking cigarettes being very bad for you. But I don't honestly think I know what the negative effects are of the nicotine itself are.
You know, the problem with nicotine is it's a vasoconstrictor. You know, there's a reason that we that in surgery we don't like smoking, and there's a reason why plastic surgeons will not do surgery on people who are smokers. You know, it impairs wound healing because it causes the blood vessels to constrict and decreases the blood flow to, you know, the incision. So, and it also does the same thing in the heart. Now, but yeah, the one that everyone worries about, the lung cancer, is clearly more associated with the combusted, you know, the products of combustion in the cigarettes. So, you know, it's kind of a philosophical question. I mean, the problem is a lot of people who smoke e-cigarettes also smoke regular cigarettes, and they end up probably getting more nicotine, but you know, again, the science is very unsettled, and it's become so politicized that it's really, you know, no matter what a group finds, they can expect themselves to be attacked from the other side.
So I guess at this point, since the science jury is still out, that it's more of a personal decision than a science-based one at this point.
Probably so, although I'm sure that I will probably hear from e-cigarette partisans. How's that, if you want to put it that way? who will tell me I'm an idiot and that, you know, my God, they really, how could you say such a thing? E-cigarettes are so much safer than cigarettes, because I've heard that before. I just haven't really seen a lot of good evidence, you know, one way or the other, at least as far as, I mean, everybody agrees you shouldn't smoke cigarettes. It's a horrible, horrible thing to do for your health. So are they safer than cigarettes? Probably. Are they safe? Not so sure about that.
David, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You'll always find links to more information about our guests and their work on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and onto iTunes, where you can subscribe to the weekly podcast or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.